Would you gentlemen stand and join us for the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Acceptance of agenda. Has everybody had a chance to look over it, and does it look like everything will be appropriate? We have a presentation, so that should come first. Everybody okay? Can we have we have mics on, it's not close enough to me. Can we have a motion to accept the agenda?
Motion.
Second. Thank you. All in favor? I think that would be me. Aye. All right. Written communications. We do have one communication from the Citizens Bike Committee and public comments. I do not believe that we have any members of the public here with us this evening, and that is too bad. We have so many chairs and so few people.
No, and then Saturdays is the 2050 workshop that will be held right here at the Vets Hall. The Saturday workshop will not be going live. I mean, the Saturday workshop will be going live. The 2050 will be going live here from the Vets Hall and will be an opportunity for people to participate in a kind of a visioning workshop. And SLOCOG is putting this on to kind of like the 2020 vision that Morro Bay did. This is a 2020 vision for the whole county. And they're looking for input from city residents as well as county residents to create a vision for what the county and particularly transportation needs might be for the county in 2050. The event at Embassy Suites is put on by Regional Water Quality Control Board and the county, and is looking at the development issues concerning water and concerning how to balance the needs of our wilderness areas and our urban areas. And that is a registration situation, but we will be presenting that on Channel 21 after the event. So I thought it applied to your board and that members of the public might be interested. So thank you.
Thank you. Nancy, do you have times on those, or is there a fee?
8:30.
8:30 in the morning?
Yeah, 8:30 on both of them. And I believe there is a registration fee for the event at Embassy Suites. And if you can call the Regional Water Quality Control Board in San Luis for that, or you can call AGP Video, and I'll give you more information.
Thank you.
So thank you.
And especially here in Morro Bay, for those of you folks interested in that, I think it's very viable. Please come out. Transportation is a very important issue. And personally, our county tends to think that it is extraneous somehow. Okay. We do have, under public comments, presentations, we have a presentation from the Cayucas Sanitation District regarding odor control measures, odor control measures in North Morro Bay. And I'm sorry we didn't get your name.
Bill Callahan.
So please give him your attention. And
Bill Callahan with the Cayucas Sanitary District. And I was recently contacted by district staff to give an update on odor control measures taken by the district on Main Street. Was relatively effective at buffering hydrogen sulfide, which causes sewer odors on Main Street, but it was not a comprehensive measure. So a few years after that, I believe in March of 2004, the district started to install biofilters on the manholes along Main Street in conjunction with ferrous chloride to help remediate odors that were still existing on Main Street. And that was a pretty effective method of odor control. I think odor complaints went down quite a bit. More recently, we we abandoned ferrous chloride and the Biotag manhole filters and started injecting a product called Bioxide at Lift Station 5. Bioxide basically eradicates hydrogen sulfide at the source, which is really a comprehensive measure in dealing with this. And we've been monitoring hydrogen sulfide levels at the Vachon Street manhole, which is right where it comes in. And we've seen a significant reduction in hydrogen sulfide readings. So I'm suggesting actually to the board tonight that this be an accepted way to address odor control in the future. And we'll continue to monitor it. We purchased a few data loggers, which record hydrogen sulfide readings, and we'll be continuing to monitor the effectiveness of bioxide, excuse me, in the future. And at this point, I can take any questions that you may have.
The first, I think the report said that the first chemical that you tried to use was a hazardous material, and that was one of the reasons that it was...
It did have a hazard, and it's also corrosive. There was a few drawbacks to using ferrous chloride.
And the filters was a maintenance issue. They didn't last as long, and they needed
manpower. They didn't really comprehensively address the hydrogen sulfide issue. They filtered hydrogen sulfide, but they did not do anything to really eradicate what was still existing in the sewer lines. And that is beneficial on a lot of different levels.
And how often are we monitoring, or how often are we getting complaints?
That's coming from the Cayuga system, so it's been and Bill's doing a good job of trying to break the disconnect that we've had over a period of years on the communications.
Okay. Yeah, and we request, that any odor complaints be directly to the district.
If I could ask, what is the phone number to call? Because people, they've called me in the past, and they call. So where do they call? Because they don't think of, not since it's in Morro Bay, people go to Morro Bay people.
Yeah, after hours, I believe, they call the on-call number, which...
Or it's in the phone book?
The district offices and the numbers in the phone book. Cayuga Sanitary District.
Yeah, the phone number is 995-3290. Yeah. Now, if people are confused or hesitant, they can certainly call public services, and we can forward the information or give them the number if they're more comfortable that way.
And what prompted you to address this in the past 3 or 4 years?
I've only been with the district for 6 months,
been an ongoing problem.
I know it's been ongoing, yes. And I was wondering, and it's great because it has been a source of irritation. And I called one of the people who had kept, when I first got appointed to PWAB, and they never called back. I know they're in town saying, there's this presentation, how's it going? I've ridden past, and I'm not surprised that there's fewer complaints. And so compliments to the agency for addressing it and whatever role you guys had in pushing it.
Right, one more question.
Sure.
What do you think is the time frame on you evaluating the
bioxide?
The bioxide. It sounded like you guys were going to continue evaluating it, but you're leaning more towards recommending that as a...
We'll continue to monitor it. Actually monitoring it with the hydrogen sulfide meters helps district staff to regulate the dosing rates for the bioxide. So that'll be ongoing continuously.
How long before you'll submit your recommendation that be adopted as the...
Probably in about a half hour. I have a board meeting.
Some things in politics really do work fast.
One further point, which is brought up by the relationship to, you'll get more of the gas.
We just pulled, printed out, and analyzed what's going on.
So there's a timeline on the data.
So yes. Yeah. Oh, yes.
Great.
Excellent. Many improvements. And also, too, there's a lot of folks in Morro Bay that have had those aromas for years. And when we used to load or offload crude oil, and we'd have those wonderful, pleasant smells throughout the community. A lot of people don't know that that's where the smell's coming from, and we're aware of it, and Cayucas is aware of it, and it's not being ignored. We are trying to find ways to correct it, and thank you for bringing the presentation and for the work that you guys are doing up there.
Okay, thank you for letting me give the presentation. Were there any other questions?
Does he need any action from this group?
No, I don't think he needed any action from us. I think he was updating us. Is that correct? You're letting
us know
the status? And I think this was planned, I think, before Member Yaroslavsky at the last meeting, September's meeting, since our October meeting was canceled. He had asked specific questions about that. He was unable to be here because of a business meeting this evening. So it wasn't a direct relation to his inquiry. It was already on tap, and you were already ready to come. Is that correct?
I believe so. I coordinated with Mr. Boucher.
Bill, that we were already on tap for this presentation and for what was going on. It wasn't.
I'd ask Bill to do that based on board discussions a couple months ago. Yes, I don't remember the precise situation, but he had asked for information, and so I did too.
It looked like in the report that we had that it said the week before our September board meeting that it was asked to be brought to our PWAB board, so I didn't know if it was just coincidental that the things came up together, or I was a little in an awkward place because a member had requested information on it, and that member's not here to benefit from the information. So that was my only concern. I don't think that the present members were unaware of what the circumstances were, but I certainly appreciate the clarification, and I hope that the folks in North Morro Bay who have concerns are also getting the information and the phone number. And appreciate that efforts are being made. So,
okay, thank you
very much. Okay, and also we have a presentation. Dr. Dorfman had some photographs up on the overhead that he would.
Just one.
Just one. Okay.
The background is, I think a couple times ago we may have had someone commenting on Quintana and Main construction, and I've got some. A couple calls, email, and this one I got out off, and I asked him. He said, "Well, it's because I'm afraid I'm going to fall over." Two other cyclists would go up into the driveway, which obviously, when it's fully developed, will be not a good situation. Fortunately, I saw Frank last night, and I think that he explained, and I want to make this general point. It's important, 2 points. It's important that if people see things that they're concerned about, they call someone. They always can call the city. The other is, this is under construction. And there'll be lots of things that will happen. And as perhaps Frank will explain it better. I presume that was the area you said that they would then grind out and make flush. Frank said, oh, there's a lot of finish work to be done after all the heavy trucks and everything go by, and it doesn't make sense to make everything perfect or everything smooth now because it's going to get cut up. But I didn't. And so the 2 points are, people, if they're concerned about things, certainly should communicate them. But this is not a finished project. Is this the, did I misunderstand? Is this the area that they would then regrind and fix? And
good evening. Madam Chair, members of the board. Yeah, one, it's not done. That's a good point. And two, the concrete itself, actually, when they're done, you know, they put this in just to facilitate getting the trucks in and out of the site, you know, temporarily while they're, you know, under construction up above. That concrete that we're looking at right there actually is going to extend toward us or to the north about another 30 or 40 feet all the way across the intersection to where the signal, you know, pedestrian push buttons are on the northwest corner. So the concrete's going to continue past that point. So all that concrete that you're looking at right there, all the asphalt you're looking at right there is all going to be taken out, and the concrete's going to continue on out of the paper.
What about this lip?
That'll disappear because the concrete's going to be brought down all the way to the bottom of your photograph.
Yeah, and that lip, I went out and looked at that lip that you're talking about. Now, granted, your photograph has a nice little shadow coming off that curb there to right, and it just perfectly lines up with that lip. But that lip is about you know, about 3/8 of an inch. So within construction standards, that's not deemed as really a, you know, what I'd call a trip fall hazard, ADA.
To stop, because not these are recreational, these are not people who are doing, you know, 100-mile bicycles. If people start stopping, the view is, I think it's critical for this for two reasons. If people start stopping there, there's traffic to the left, they're going to stop, they're going to be facing in the future a traffic light, and they're going to have to get off, go into the driveway, but more likely they're going to ride into the driveway with traffic coming down. They did such a beautiful job. If it just looked like it did the way they did the upper part, it, even though that's going to change, that was beautifully done. That's all. But an equally important point is we don't know what it's going to look like till it's done, because they've got a lot lot to go. And there were other things people have called out. And once I got the idea, I said, you know, wait till the end. It's being watched.
Okay.
I don't know where Nancy is. We can turn that off.
And is there any way that maybe a couple of caution pylons could be out there just to alert people to coming out during the remainder of the construction? Would that be more of a hazard, Frank? That would be more of a hazard.
Yeah,
it's a pretty narrow spot.
Like I said, when you really go out there, it's about 3/8 of an inch, which is not really a biking hazard. And I hate to throw this out there, but perhaps they stop because that's a signalized intersection.
No, I went up and asked them. One gentleman told me, he said, I always pedaled all the way up, but I'm afraid I'm going to fall off. Two other people went up into the driveway, and they said, because that's too bumpy. Now, they had no problem. They were young kids hopping the thing, but that major part of that, they'll have the full bike lane. But we can ask the cyclist after, you know, we have all this, put the cyclist committee to work, and I don't cycle anymore, so I don't know.
It's just what they told me.
Okay. Bill, you didn't have any questions on that, did you?
No.
Okay.
We have to see what they do with it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Microphone, Bill. And Mr. Olson is not avoiding us. We have not banished him over to the other side of the room. He's feeling a little under the weather and is keeping his distance. And without him, we would not have quorum. So I appreciate you coming tonight, Bill. Thank you. Okay, and we move on to item number 6, consent calendar for our minutes of our September 21st meeting, our October meeting.
That was the idea, so substitute the word precise on critical policy points. Because they already
can you
are
tell
concise.
Us what paragraph
oh,
were
you? Item 6. I'm sorry, consent calendar, actually.
Substitute precise for concise?
Precise on critical policy points, because that's to make them precise in every way, but it's whether that's agreed. That was the point I was trying to make, because some things were said, and the parking was such an important, potentially controversial issue, I thought. Those kinds of things, it's very important to.
So if we end that sentence and just add on policy issues?
On critical, on critical, or on policy issues is fine.
So right after concise, just on policy issues?
Precise on policy.
Precise.
Because they already are concise, although very well done.
Okay. Bill, do you have any comments on that or any corrections that you need to make? Okay. I have one that I would like under item, where is it, 9B. It says, consideration of membership of PWAB. Landis said attendance of the board was a city council concern. That was not exactly what I said. I felt when I read that it made it sound like I was putting it off on council. It's a serious concern of this board and of me personally. And I think what it was that I was saying was that it was council's authority. So if we could change concern to authority, I would greatly appreciate that. Anybody okay with that? And nothing else? Okay. Can we have a motion to accept the minutes with corrections?
I so move.
All in favor? Aye. It feels a little silly asking all in favor when I'm the only one left.
This discussion for a moment of humor about the minutes and whether they say what we said reminds me of the old Mayor Daley, the older Mayor Daley in the city of Chicago, said something that he shouldn't have, and when it was quoted in the paper, he berated the reporter, saying, quote what I mean, not what I said.
Wouldn't the world be interesting if we could do that? On to item number 7. On to item number 7, director's information report.
Fortunate this year that the stream flows in Choro Creek are high enough that we're able to operate the wells in the Choro Valley. So we are meeting all the demands of the community with groundwater. It's kind of a nostalgia thing. So actually, we did get a call from one gentleman that said, I've lived here 30 years, and this water tastes like it did 15 years ago. Said, you are correct, sir. Absolutely right. So we're using groundwater. Everything's going well. We're meeting the demands comfortably. The desalter is ready to operate in case it's needed, but it's dozing. It's ready to operate if necessary. On the Harbor Walk project, we submitted our application to the Coastal Commission for the permits. Monday, we received a response from them. They had some additional things they wanted to see, landscaping plan, irrigation, and some things like that. And we'll be putting that package together of the additional information they want to see, and we'll get it back to them. You will notice that on tonight's meeting, as I mentioned earlier, the sewer collection system master plan update is not on. What we came across is some additional information came to light, and Steve Tanaka, our consultant engineer, has been working on it feverishly. He's been short-staffed, so he's been kind of going a little bit crazy. I just got the stuff late this afternoon, 15 pages of revisions. We'll be going over them. Now he probably collapsed in a heap, and he's going to take a couple weeks off, so he won't be back until the second week of December, so it won't be till then that we can have our staff-level discussion. So I really don't think that we would be prepared to bring the item to you until January. That'll give us time to iron out the final draft. Underground Utility District 6 and 7, we'll be talking about underground utilities a little bit later, but I wanted to tell you that I met with the utility companies yesterday on District 7, and we have reached agreement on the boundaries of the district. This was a district that this board took action on a little more than a year ago. It's taken us some time to get it coordinated with the utilities, and the district boundaries are essentially Main Street from Dunes to Highway 1 and Beach Street from Main to Embarcadero. I'll have some photos of those areas a little bit later on.
Information rather than slow, so please understand we're not stonewalling your public comment. We look forward to it, most likely in January of next year. Back to staff.
Good evening, Madam Chair, board members. I have about four things I was going to run past you in the director's report. First was the Blanca water tank replacement project. As you might note in there, it's completed. We took the notice of completion to the city council on Monday night. All that went through, so it's pretty much a done deal. We have one residual payment to make, but for the most part, it's a done deal. It's up and operating, and as far as I know, Mr. Dave Phillips is happy. He has a new facility. I also wanted to throw out if any of the board members, or if, for that matter, any of the public would like to come up and take a look at the facility since it's new and it's kind of neat. Bill or myself would be happy to give a little tour. It is a gated, locked community now. With the Homeland Securities, we're having to kind of protect those type of facilities a little better. So if you are interested in taking a tour, give me a call at Public Services. Second thing, and this is a tale on Mr. Boucher mentioning the state water shutdown. While the state water shutdown is going on, we are using the wells, especially the wells at the Morrow well field, where we have that infamous MTBE plume lingering out there. So I was bringing it to your attention here that we have been monitoring out of the monitoring wells, taking samples, and we've gotten the results back from last Tuesday and last Friday thus far, and there's been no detected MTBE hits in any of the monitoring wells, so things seem to be going well with that. The other thing I wanted to bring up was a couple of the pending city council items. And a couple of these items have been kind of shifting around a little bit, so I'm going to throw this out, but it still may change again. And one is a one-way circulation on the Embarcadero. The city council had brought that up a couple months ago, wanted to get moving on it, wanted staff to go back and do some detailed engineering cost estimates and feasibility, and get some information back to them pretty quick. The city council wants to move. I believe that's going to go to council on the 12th of December, and we'll go from there. The other one was the creek,
is it our report or is the issue being raised anew? Maybe I didn't quite grasp.
The city council is just asking staff to look at, and this is one way, and I think a little bit different is some of the earlier concepts was looking at one lane, one way with possible diagonal parking, and the concepts were partly to have the possibility of widening the sidewalks on the west side of the Embarcadero for better pedestrian access. But as we went out and looked, we have about 39 feet across from curb to curb, and you actually can't get a lane down the middle with diagonal parking. So that concept kind of went out the door. I think from my understanding, the issue is a lot of delivery trucks and, circulation, and, they just want to do something a little different, make some improvements down there, and try to keep it as simple as possible. And I think the concept is to actually have both lanes going in one direction, either northbound or southbound, so that if a delivery truck were to have to make a delivery and they're stuck out in a lane, traffic can still go around them safely. Right now, the way it is, you get a milk delivery or something out there, and they park out there outside in the travel lane. People are a little hesitant to go around them because they might fear a head-on. So I think that's the general concept. The other one was, it's actually going to be more in your court, but I was bringing it to your attention here under City Council, is the staff had received a petition from quite a few, several hundred residents regarding the intersection of South Bay Boulevard and Quintana Road. And there is a couple of proposed developments down in that general area. So that's an item that I'm actually going to bring to PWAB, hopefully in December. But what I'm waiting for is the developers that are proposing a 29-unit tract down in that area by the Blue Heron, mobile home park. I've asked that developer to get a licensed traffic engineer to do a traffic study of that intersection, and so they're looking at all the geometrics of it and the traffic, the accident history, and looking at the feasibility.
Isn't that close enough to the freeway that Caltrans has a strong say in that situation?
They will.
They seem to always. I didn't know if that was going to be. I don't know how that works when a private developer has to get a traffic engineer.
Well, the traffic engineer, if they're doing their job, will hopefully make contact with Caltrans, because if the signal were to back up on that southbound South Bay Boulevard, it could obviously back up and interfere with the on and off ramps, at the Highway 1, South Bay interchange.
So the benefit of the traffic engineer is that they should have the experience to incorporate the flow of the bigger picture.
Well, they should be taking all that stuff into account. Yeah.
Okay. I know a lot of the public doesn't understand how much control Caltrans has over, X number of feet from the freeway, and so many things that we'd like to do in our city that we can't because we're shot down, and it continues to be a problem whose interests are served.
Last but not least is you know, under the sidewalks and ADA compliance, I was just bringing to your attention that we're continuing to make some strides. I noted on there that we've got numerous new locations with new sidewalk that's ADA compliant, including handicap ramps. Surf and Main Street, actually both the northwest and the southeast corner, you know, have new sidewalk. Matter of fact, we're out paving today on Surf Street, and we were scheduled to pave tomorrow, but now it's been postponed till Monday to pave around the front end there of that southeast corner of Surf and Main. Got the new building there. We've also got some new sidewalk out in front of Taco Temple up in the north end of town, Main Street. And we've got some new sidewalk and handicap ramp at 41 and Main at the Chevron station.
Excellent.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're doing well.
So I thought I'd at least throw that out on the table.
Thank you.
You bet.
I wanted to bring to your attention, since we're on that issue, Market Street at Morro Bay Boulevard, the southeast corner where we have that ADA-required tactile high visibility. It is coming unglued. It is a trip fall hazard. And if you could send somebody out there to take a look at it, if you're standing at that southeast corner and you're facing west, getting ready to cross, it is that direction. One of the two pieces that's there is coming. It's lifting up.
That's actually been re-glued probably 6 months ago. So some of the corners, and you start seeing stress cracks in them and everything else. So.
Well, I know that we've discussed this, that they were mandated for the vision impaired. I am a vision impaired person. I'm legally blind. And they are hell. They are hell on everyone I know with a vision problem. The dots are too big. They stand up too tall. They, you know, a finer texture works much better to know what's going on. And I know you guys are stuck because, you know, stuff is mandated. You know, for me, the high contrast is helpful, and we're losing that with the UV fading. I know they've installed them quite a bit on Cal Poly campus, and they don't seem to be fading. I don't know if they've got access to another distributor. I think earlier when we talked, there was only one distributor.
They're starting to come up with different, I'm not going to say manufacturers, but different products. Some of them are actually made out of thermoplastic, and some of them are made out of epoxy. So there's different materials now being used, you know, for them. The watching issue on the truncated domes, I think that'll be interesting, is because for years everybody kind of scurried around to put them in, and then the issue kind of died out as far as federal ADA versus state ADA versus, you know, local standards and stuff. And now we're starting to see that those truncated domes actually kind of conflict. And what they conflict in is that, you know, they're required for the, you know, for the visually impaired, and yet they also, some of the new ADA standards are looking for what they call a low vibration zone. So when you're, you know, moving along, say in a wheelchair, they're not wanting to have a lot of these joint, you know, expansion joints and cracks going over there. That, you know, that's sends a discomfort up for somebody who may be quadriplegic or whatever the situation is. And so they're looking for trying to eliminate a lot of these expansion joints and these vibration stuff. Well, the truncated domes, you know, violate the low vibration zone. So a little conflict in the plan. So yet to see how that pans out.
Well, even within the disabled community, something that helps one person with a disability can hinder another. And hopefully at the local level, people know that their input is still valuable and even necessary. So I hope that some of my fellow vision impaired folks and some of the folks that I know that use walkers and crutches and wheelchairs will comment as they see fit. Dr. Dorfman, do you have any questions? No? Bill, did you have any questions? Okay. Nope, you're all set? Okay. Okay, on to item number 8, old business. We're going to start with 8A, appointment of a vice chair. Now, this is an interesting appointment, being that there are three members here, and I obviously can't be chair and vice chair both. So I'd like to ask both of you gentlemen if either one of you would be willing to volunteer. This is going to be vice chair for our December meeting if we carry, and our January meeting, and that will be it. Our February meeting, we will most likely have new members, and we will be electing a new chair and vice chair at that point. So this would be maximum of two meetings. Turn your microphone on there, Bill. He's going to choke now.
Yeah. I say, for what it's worth, I'll volunteer. It doesn't amount to much.
Dr. Dorfman, how are you with that? Would you like to volunteer? Okay. Well, then, shall we just acknowledge consensus, or do we need a formal motion for that, don't we?
I move for the remainder of is it the year, or for December, January, or
for the remainder of our calendar year?
The January, I'm confused, because January's...
Our year goes from January 31st to January 31st.
To the end of the term recently vacated, that Mr. Olson be vice chair.
Okay, well, second. Bill, you going to vote for yourself? I think we're consensus there. And I don't think that I'll be missing December's meeting if we fly. I have medical appointments in December, and it appears that I can get there and back before our meeting.
And if you miss it, then just one other, John.
I think on our bylaws, we're gonna get to that on the next.
Yeah, we wouldn't have a quorum.
Exactly. We need three of us here at this point, or we're just going to have to cancel a meeting. So I appreciate the contact. Okay, on to 8B, continued discussion of board membership regarding absences. And I'd like to say I have not heard from the council, either formally or individually, regarding the status of this board's authority to determine whether or not absences are... Do you know which paragraph that was in of the...
Down here.
Okay. Thank you. Wow. Absences. It says absence of a board member from three consecutive meetings without formal consent of the board, as noted in its official minutes, will constitute the voluntary resignation of the absent member, and the position will be declared vacant. That implies that the board has the authority to determine whether or not an absence is excused or not, but we've never had any mechanism for actually doing that. Members typically will call staff and let them know that they're not going to be here. And this last meeting, our last meeting was canceled a week before what would have been our October meeting. Bob Croyle let me know that he was not going to be here this evening. He had a trip that was planned before he was appointed. I got an email as well as staff yesterday, I believe from John Yaroslavsky, saying that he would not be able to be here this evening. I'm not sure how to proceed with this. Some of our concerns were if we become too strict with tit for tat on who's absent and whether or not it's excused, we might discourage volunteerism on a board like this, and we certainly don't want to do that. We also need to make sure that when we take these appointments, that we really seriously consider our time involvement and really contribute to the city. I've been very concerned because, frankly, over the last year, I think our board has been significantly dysfunctional when it comes to productivity. Mm-hmm. I haven't been happy at all with it. And, it's a commitment you make, or you decide that you can't do it anymore. And we're here to serve the community, not our own interests. And we're here to serve the community as best as we can with our experience. And so it's a personal issue for me. In the sense of responsibility and commitment. And I know that I put a great deal of effort into considering whether or not time management would be appropriate for me on my first term, and even more so on my second term with my school schedule. And, I'd like to have a little discussion on what you gentlemen think. I wish we had all of our members here. One of the things that I think is important, we may only have two meetings left before our new session begins. And I think that it's important for us to kind of establish where this board's going to go in its own functioning, where we're going to go, how we're going to serve the city, and our commitment to that purpose. So I'm a little productivity, and that's why we're here. We're not really here to just meet and have us people watch us on TV. We're here to serve the community. And at a time like this right now where there's a lot of things that are bogged down, we don't really have the funds to do many things in our city, and that's unfortunate. But, you know, it doesn't mean that we need to sit on our hands and do nothing. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, and I think we can contribute a little bit more if we're active and we're involved. So that said, do any of you have any ideas about what you think should be excused or non-excused, or whether we leave it alone and just leave it if you're absent three consecutive times, you're voluntarily resigned?
I might interject. Didn't the council took an action recently where I believe it was they made a determination that absences would be three consecutive or four in a calendar year.
And they were going to drop off the excused or non-excused.
Yes.
Okay.
That so I think there's been an refinement to the policy that's come from them.
Okay.
That's an action to apply to advisory boards and or the planning commission or, and I, well, I'm very glad to hear that because I think that solves quite a bit of the problem. We just have to keep good records and just apply that in the spirit. I agree with what you said about the dysfunctionality. It didn't take long when we had almost everyone here for a couple meetings in a row to get going on things, not always agreeing, but it was a good dialogue. I remember a couple subcommittees got formed to look at things. We really can't do that. And I think past is past for this past year, and I I'm thinking, be frank, of current membership, that we just say this is the expectation, and if you really think, if you're really not confident you can keep it, then you have to consider your membership. Because I know people will start out with every good not with every good intention, honestly believing they'll be able to make it, and things change in their lives. But I think if we start that year clearly, and maybe through our discussion, clearly having learned of this, that we very much in...
Throw my perspective on this. This actually came about, I believe, back in August, where the city council had addressed the issue of, you know, they were starting to lose some members of the advisory boards, and so they had started talking about it, and they were scheduling an item, and I believe it's for January, to discuss, you know, the size of the advisory boards. So that's where this item kind of got started over here, and when I think the item came to you in September, it was actually more centered around a discussion of, since we had lost, you know, a member, and we had a lot of absences kind of pending out there, that it was centered around, was there an interest to voice your opinion as far as, you know, as a board, to go on record of whether you recommended going from, you know, staying as a 7-member board or returning back to a 5-member board. And I think I didn't go to that meeting in September. I was absent. But somehow or another, at that discussion, it got into the definitions of absences and unexcused absences. So it kind of got off into a, you know, a second consideration. But the original focus was, you know, your board, you know, whether you wanted to go on record for the city council in January of whether you want to stay as a 7 or drop down to a 5. And then, of course, you've lost another board member, you know, even more recently. So you are down to 5.
And for clarification, we're technically a 7-member board with 5 acting members. That's why 3 of us are a quorum, because of the 2 resignations.
So I didn't want to lose, because I think that was the intent way back, was to try to, you know, have a discussion on whether you wanted 7 or 5 and go on record. Because if we don't have a meeting in December, I'm not sure you'll have time to go on record if the city council does, in fact, address that in January. Did that help?
Yeah, because it's very important to bring that up. My memory is, I don't know if we took a vote, but a consensus was that And what happened in the dialogue was that one at seven because of the breadth and the ability for subcommittees, but the more fundamental point was whether it's five or seven, people have to work together as a group. And it really doesn't fix the problem of people fulfilling their commitments if you make it five. See, that, remember, and that's how then we got focused on it. But
and council have made the decision that we'll just hold off until January to decide whether or
not. It's not taken seriously. I mean, that's a chicken-egg kind of thing. You have an exciting board where are getting into things because there is the issues being addressed once reports are received and we get into things. Then people, well, that'd be interesting. And so it's a we get into a chicken egg kind of thing here. And so I mean that's why I think another try at seven and a little more. I've already started talking to people saying, "Will you apply?" And I think we have to, because so often what's happened in past years, the notice goes out and 2 weeks later and they say we didn't get any applications. You know, so we should act like there's going to be at least two vacancies, and I hope beat the bushes for people to apply.
I'm a firm believer in open information. If we're going to have positions, and I like to see them, I like to see the public notified in time for them to put serious thought into it. You know, watch a few meetings, see if it's appropriate for them, and that's on any board, no matter what the size is. Bill, what kind of comments would you like to offer on this?
Well, excuse me. I start off. You know I cough. On this bottom paragraph, absence from meetings, you know, it reads, absence of a board member from three consecutive meetings, which is a little sloppy. You know, we could cut that down to two. But it says, without formal consent, and we've all been a little, informal on that too. If somebody can't come, they've just called one of the other members who I've had people call me and I say, okay, I'll tell them. And you know, we've always considered that okay, but maybe we ought to spell out that they call. If they can't attend, they call the board secretary.
Yeah, there's never been a formal mechanism that members know exactly
so
what to do if they're not going to be there.
I suggest that we do that. Make it call the board secretary. You know, and but meetings without formal consent should be, you know, three is even kind of long on that. But, you know, if somebody's not going to be here, they can let us know.
Yeah.
It's not that tough a thing. So if
council actually stated that they kept with the three, right?
Three consecutive, but four in any year, and then
right.
Yeah. That is a formal that they're going to incorporate that because.
For all boards, as far as three consecutive or four in a calendar year?
But they had a notifying back to the council.
I was not at that meeting, and I do not know if that was a formal action. I certainly, it seemed to be a consensus from what I understand, but I don't know that it was formally acted upon. But as was pointed out, I do believe that council is going to take this up kind of in a global perspective in January.
Okay. Because I can see us sending a motion to council supporting that idea, but I don't want to do something that's contrary to something they've just put into, you know, into play.
See,
I think I'd like all the boards to be consistent through the city, frankly.
Did you bring in a revised paragraph for that, Dickie? I believe I said something that effect last, you know, I was hoping you would bring in a revised paragraph.
Well, I didn't bring the ones the minutes for the packet from the last meeting, but it specifically said something about the four in a calendar year, and this one does not.
I don't think it is. How do people? I would personally drop the consecutive and just say three meetings, because four meetings is saying that it's 75% attendance. It's not, you know, and something always gets canceled. I just say three meetings without formal consent, and hopefully we work out and the consent. It doesn't, without formal consent, which can be either prior or retrospective.
Well, see, there's a problem. It's like three meetings without formal consent, and we don't define formal consent.
Yeah,
I have a problem with the structure of it.
Formal consent, it's sort of like impeaching. the president. It's whatever Congress or whatever the group says it is. But it can be done. Well, see, I think in actual practice, a lot would fall to the chair to talk to the person saying, gee, this is your second, you know, meeting, what's going on or whatever.
And I know you thought that I should, you know, engage some of the members that were absent, and I felt that I wanted to be a good leader, but I didn't feel that was my authority to do that.
Yeah, I know, because it was so unclear. But you'd hope that process would take place, and it is our commitment to each other to serve. Because if someone, whatever happens, and they have three meetings, someone's going on a trip for 2 months, and I get sick, and it just happened, I get sick 1 month, we all have things, and the next month I've got to go, I'm so worried about one of my kids. But otherwise I've been coming, I participate, and I'd say, can you take one of those illness, one of those ones that were for illness, and I realize it's my third and fourth because I took this trip, and give formal consent so I'm not off the board. And if I keep on not being able to make it.
So if I'm understanding, you think that the basically the way it's worded now is all right, but the board could then...
Except for consecutive. I would strike the consecutive. Because that means I could only... I would come to every fourth meeting and still be okay.
Well, I understand. But what I'm getting at is you would rather see the consent of the board be to discuss and excuse a person's absences if they reach that limit for circumstances.
Yeah,
I just want to make sure I'm understanding.
Yes, but by saying formal consent of the board, that does that, because the board can say, no, we're not going to discuss it, or we're going to discuss it.
Well, what constitutes formal consent?
A majority vote.
But the board is not going to meet during that period of time. If somebody comes up 3 days before the meeting, he's not going to be here. There's not going to be a meeting of the board to have a vote to give formal consent. That's why I suggested that they call the secretary of the board and let her know, and then theoretically that should constitute proper notice. But the board is not going to be there to vote on it.
But that's notice, not formal consent.
Right, but I think he's talking about voting on it after the third meeting has been missed. We've got plenty of time to know that a member's not been here.
Yeah.
And to agendize discussion on it, or a discussion action item on it. Say we have a member, I think what Barry is trying to say is, if we have a member that has, for circumstances beyond their control, has missed three consecutive meetings, where it would be assumed, but what I'm saying is I'm going by what the current language is without
the board
changes.
The board would vote on expulsion, yes.
Well, he's not saying that. He's not saying the board would vote on expulsion.
Well,
he's saying the board would vote on excusing it. He's saying the opposite direction.
But it's the same thing. Because he's got it. I was trying to explain.
Of course, you're talking
the spirit
about
of it, but procedurally
you're talking about
right.
You're talking about the number of meetings missing. I'm talking about, of course, the individual meeting.
About the what?
The individual meeting,
yeah.
Which we got. See,
the individual.
The person is supposed to be excused for each meeting.
Well,
see.
I think what would be, you know, extraneous circumstances leading to the absence, that the board could, on its own power, say, we believe this member should stay or we believe the member should go. But the language of this right now, it's really out of our hands in a way, because it's assumed that on the third consecutive absence, we are accepting the person's resignation without any further discussion.
Well, except whatever, without formal consent of the board, without defining that, but that's when it's not defined. When it's not defined, you just obviously there's a discussion in the board, and it would imply, though, you have to consent to the absences as they happen or in advance.
My ultimate goal with this is to have language that's clear, that all the members understand what is expected of them and what the consequences will be if that isn't met. You know, whether it's three meetings or four meetings, but I'm concerned that nobody seems to be able to interpret it. And I think that if they interpreted it, they would either not be absent or they would make direct contact with us. Now, what happened in the past? What happened in the past was people that were absent would call 3 o'clock in the afternoon and say, I'm not going to be there. You know, without being ill, I don't think that's appropriate. And I also am concerned with the fact that, I mean, we all have email. John did a very nice thing by sending an email to staff and, I believe, each of the members on the board. We all knew at the same time that he was not going to be able to be here. You know, rather than calling one person, what if our secretary is ill that day? Are we going to have an email go to somebody that's never going to know and we all show up at the meeting? And
well, a way to get around the notification is simply, and if this is the direction the council's taking or drifting, one absence of a board member from three consecutive meetings or four meetings during any year will constitute the voluntary resignation. Mm-hmm. Forget the formal consent. We get into the problems of how to define it, how to procedurally implement it, and if it's really someone who is very unusual set of circumstances should continue on the board, they advertise the vacancy and decide and can reappoint. But it gets us out of all these procedural machinations we're trying to go through to make something work by simply endorsing the concept of using the language of the board, apparently.
Motion to replace that paragraph.
Yeah. I move that this paragraph be replaced by the following paragraph. Absence of a board member from three consecutive meetings or a total of four meetings during any board year will constitute the voluntary resignation of the absent member, and the position will be declared vacant. But no, I've got to change the language. Excuse me. Absence of a board member from three consecutive meetings or four meetings during any consecutive 12-month period will constitute the voluntary resignation of the absent member, and the position will be declared vacant.
I like the language of using a board term rather than 12 months.
Well,
that means from January 31st to January 31st.
But that means I'll use up my three vacancies. I only intend to come 75% of the time. Then I get another 75%.
Well, I agree with that.
Yeah, okay. You know.
Okay. It's any consecutive 12 months. And they have four times, it's 70.
Well, it was certainly easy enough to go back and find out, you know, what our absent and present record was when we were going through this before a couple
of
months.
You should be required to come more than one.
I want this, obviously, only to apply prospectively.
Prospectively meaning?
Well, we should be looking at the past year and total up people's absences for the past year.
So effective January 31st, 2006?
Yes, because I don't think that's fair to change the rules.
Well, can somebody read back that motion so we know what we're talking about?
I can give it.
Actually, I think it's pretty straightforward. It's the existing paragraph.
Yeah.
Absence of a board member from three consecutive meetings, and then we strike out some words and substitute,
right,
or four meetings in any consecutive 12-month period, and we have now struck out the next words, up to, and we'll go back to, will constitute the voluntary resignation of the absent member, and the position will be declared vacant.
And that was your motion?
Yeah.
I second the motion.
Should we add to that something about how they notify, though, if they're going to be absent, or should that be a separate paragraph?
It doesn't matter.
Separate sentence.
I think that could
call the board secretary.
Call the board secretary?
You know, in the office.
Because
what's going
to
happen?
That has to do with counting up a quorum.
Should there be a
quorum?
I can't tell. She's shaking her head up and down and sideways at the same time.
Yeah.
Well, I think if you have a person, like a board secretary,
a person or a position,
then if that person's not there, you know, then you leave a message on Kathy's phone line or on my phone line, and then that falls into the hole that you were referring to earlier. And so I don't know how you would construct the language to to talk to a live staff member of the department, you know.
Does this have to be there's bylaws, which is the governance, but can we have just rather than do it in the bylaws, pass a motion with a procedure?
The council approves it. We can pass a motion that's procedural, but council has to approve it for it to be formal, especially if it's a change into our bylaws.
No, but if, rather than put in the bylaws how people notify, just say we'll propose the mechanism and pass it as these are the procedures.
I think putting it in the bylaws are the only way to make it stay in our procedure. Is that... Okay. Would staff concur with that, or
is there anything in Robert's Rules?
I've never looked in that section of Robert's Rules to look for that, so I can't say whether it would carry any more weight. It would certainly carry more weight if it's in the bylaws.
Well, my concern is that we have there's so many times when we have these wonderful ideas, and if they're not put into record, they get lost.
Well, then,
so I think it's a good idea.
There would be absence. For meetings, there would be a new section titled
Notification of Absence.
Notification of Absence. A board member anticipating an absence is to notify by phone or email. I'm trying to say
not having one, and until this meeting, I have not been notified by a single member who's been absent.
Yeah.
And it's not that I personally, like Vic, really needs to know that you won't be here.
Well, I had John.
It's the fact that it's nice to know before we get here. It's especially nice for staff and for AGP Video to know that we will not have a quorum, so that these people don't have to come down here and set up. Us televise and then have to cancel.
Well, John Lemon called me several times, you know.
It's nice that somebody gets in contact with a board member, physically, you know, somebody that's going to be here at the meeting.
But I always carried out, you know, and John will be here.
Bill, what you're talking about is something like this. So you're talking about notifying a designated city employee?
No, I'd say they can inform the department. It could be me, it could be Frank, it could be Kathy, it could be someone else in the department.
But it should be public services department, not
should
city
be someone in public services. I'm not sure how we structure the language.
No,
that,
I understand what
that
you're saying.
You know,
the idea is that they notify someone in notify the public services department such notification to be confirmed by direct personal contact, by direct personal interaction.
Well, that might imply that it's face-to-face.
Well, direct personal interaction.
About direct response. A direct response?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Why not just say if a member is going to be absent, he must notify the public services department before the meeting period.
Because we've had members that have sent emails at 4:30 and they've sent them to people who've been ill, and no one here knew that that person would not be here.
Notify the public service department.
Let's issue the telephone then.
At the earliest possible time.
At the earliest possible
time. Said notification is acknowledged as received by direct response.
Thank you,
yes.
Mr. Boucher.
Yes.
He's earned his income again.
Yeah, because then the direct response can be a return email. It has been acknowledged by direct response. Because that's your point. You have the obligation to...
Confirmation will cover a lot of that stuff. Just go ahead and give it to me again.
Confirmed as received.
In short.
Okay. A board member anticipating an absence shall notify the Public Services Department at the earliest possible time, and further, said notification is not considered complete
until confirmed
as received by direct response.
Until confirmed is really all you need. That says it all.
Well, it doesn't say who's confirming it. I can send my email. There are people who think, I'm going to send my email twice so I confirm it. I told them once and I told them again.
But that's not confirmed.
I know, but... It
is ridiculous that we really need to do this, okay. But if we don't do it, we're going to be right back to square one when it comes up again.
Read the language again. Sorry.
A new section to be added, notification of absence. A board member anticipating an absence shall notify the Public Services Department at the earliest possible time, and further, said notification is not considered complete until confirmed as received by direct response.
Thank you.
I move that language.
All approve. I second it.
Aye. I think that's unanimous. Thank you, Mr. Boucher.
That's it?
That's it. That's it for that one.
Then we have this other thing, of course, the second paragraph. You know, the Public Works Advisory Board shall consist of 7 voting members, 5 of which must be qualified electors of the City of Morro Bay.
This is new to me.
Pardon?
This is new to me. I've never heard our board to have members that were not residents of the City of Morro Bay.
And I think it should be 5 members who must be qualified electors of the City of Morro Bay.
You want to see our board reduced to 5 members?
Yeah, I think because the Planning Commission gets along on 5, the Council gets along on 5. You know, we don't do anything more complicated than they do, for pity's sakes. And you add 2 more members, you can easily add an hour to every item on the agenda.
Right, but we're not adding 2 members.
You're wasting staff time, well, everybody else's time. If we can get the job done with 5, I say the Council seems to get by on 5. And the Planning Commission is 5. No, you know, who needs it?
What is the Rex and Parks? That's some of a holdover when they had the separate boards. So you really wanted the water board to have...
Well, that's how we got started, you know. It came with the people from the different boards all came. You wound up with 7 because of the number of people involved from the different boards. So,
well, not
2 each, you know, plus 1 or something like that, I believe it was.
Not simply the number of people, but the scope of what's dealt with, because we haven't recently, but there's the, you know, the cable TV kind of thing, which is a whole different set of considerations.
Well, actually, we went to 7 a couple of years ago.
We went to 7 when Nancy Johnson and I were appointed, and I am in my 4th or 5th year. Mm-hmm. So
we're down to 5. When the board was originally formed from... the streets and trees and the solid waste and the cable and the television, the franchise and all that stuff. We actually had 7 people at that time, because 2 came from each of these 3 different sources, plus there was 1 that was appointed.
And then we went down through attrition to 5 members.
Then by attrition went on to 5 eventually, and then eventually we went back to 7. We got along pretty good on 5 when we were going up, you know.
What is your view, Vicki?
Well, my concern about this one paragraph is the fact that we have a place for 2 members on our board that are not citizens of the city. And in my understanding, the only thing in all of the scope that we do that has anything to do with anybody outside the city is the issues with Cayucas and the JPA. And that's 1 issue of everything we do. I don't know if that's enough to constitute having members that are not citizens of the city.
I don't think so. And I heard Bill thinking that everyone should be citizens. When I was asking, what do you think, I think, as far as the size.
Well, so I wanted to say that's my important issue. Well, okay, here's my take on the size, okay? My understanding of group dynamics is maybe 5 people can work better than 7. A dysfunctional 5 is far less appropriate than a functional 7. What I do not like is any action on a board or in government that is done specifically for 1 circumstance. I think changing the side of a board for 1 reason will come back to bite you a year later. Okay, at this point I cannot support reducing the size of our board to 5 members. I think it's I think it's misdirected, and I think we need a kickstart, and I think we need some new energy on the board, and I think if we continue the way we've been for the next year, we won't produce much. So at this point...
But I think we're in agreement on eliminating... The Public Works Advisory Board shall consist of voting members, all of whom must be qualified electors of the City of Morro Bay.
Yep.
And I...
And just take the five of which? Strike the five of which?
Yeah, just say all of whom must be qualified electors of Morro Bay, of the City of Morro Bay. And I may feel differently in a year about the size. I want to take one step at a time. I think it's been a tough year. We'll see how recruitment goes and appointment goes, because in this city, which has been through a lot with, and I'm talking about the politics of it, and the diversity, I think that if we can get enough people to apply, I think it's healthier for the city to have as much breath feel in the political arena, frankly, that it's represented in various...
Please don't let us go to more than seven members.
No.
Our problem has been absences. It hasn't been five or seven. It hasn't been the size. It's been absences
and
participation.
And let's take... And I may feel differently in a year, but I agree with you. Let's take one problem at a time. So I move that the appointments paragraph be revised to read, the Public Works Advisory Board shall consist of seven voting members, all of whom must be qualified electors of the City of Morro Bay.
Did we have, was Bill already in the process of a motion?
Bill?
Your discussion, had you made formal motion as far as changing the size of the board?
I did not make a motion. No.
Okay, because I didn't want interruption of your motion. I wanted to hear it out.
If I made a motion, it would consist of five members, all of whom are electors in Morro Bay.
But we're all in agreement on the entire board, be it five or seven, being electors of Morro Bay. Okay. So your motion, I didn't mean to interrupt, I just wanted to clarify so that I wasn't getting out of order.
So we're making the same only...
But apparently if I make such a motion, it would lose.
Yeah,
so.
He's not...
You might as well say you've already had the vote.
Well, no, but still, it would have been a matter of order. It would not have been appropriate.
It would not have been appropriate for me to
do that. And like I said, it's not the size of the board. I think that the change in the board quite often, in any of the boards, in the size of the board... although it sounds good on paper, frankly, has been for political reasons. People do or do not want particular people on boards, and I don't think that it's really ethical for us to move in that direction. I think we should judge the size of our board by the makeup of the city, not by what the nature of current politics is. I just think that that's not the kind of work that I want to do for the city. So I would second your motion.
If I may be entirely... out of order.
Thank you.
Nancy Castle. The reason that I recollect that the board was set up to allow for members out that are voters outside of the city limits was for the business community. Those people who are impacted by traffic and the issues that you are concerned with, who own businesses in Morro Bay but live in other places. Okay. And it's just an openness to allow that community to participate if they are interested and can.
Okay.
And so I've been sitting back there knowing it wasn't really appropriate, but
it's input that we didn't have. I didn't see why it was there, and you're giving me a reason, because like I said, the only thing that I thought that our board dealt with...
The Harbor Advisory Board also has that openness to it, as does Recreation and Parks, because it's recognized that this is a region that has interconnectivity. And certainly I know that in times past there have been people who have been very interested in some of the issues before this board that didn't live in the city but did own businesses. So I just add that to your discussion.
Thank you. Nope. New information I'm always open to.
Why not the Planning Commission, then?
If we're talking about business people and stuff, the Planning Commission is affected by that, is in fact have more, it's probably more important in their case than it is with us. There's no reason why we aren't open-minded to listen to people who have business people who come in here who have some problem, and just that because they don't live here doesn't mean we don't listen to them.
We're also allowed to have members that are members of subcommittees that are not residents.
You know, I know that the Parks and Rec, because of the things they do, affect people outside, and the same with the harbor. But we don't do those things outside the city.
Well, the only thing that was coming to my mind was the issue with wastewater in Cayucas. But in the years that I've been in the city, I don't believe that anyone outside the city has ever
really
applied for this board.
That's taken care of.
Well, it appears that way.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to jump to a conclusion, and I appreciate Nancy stepping in, because that's new information and something I had not considered. Does that change your motion? No.
No.
Okay. I will maintain my second. And do we need that read back?
Now we're talking about sticking with them. This motion consists of sticking with 7-0.
Yeah.
Okay. You want to vote?
Did you get your mic on? Okay. The motion was before us. We have a motion and a second and a vote. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed.
Okay. It's 2-1. Member Olson declined, saying, voting no.
Just for a point of knowledge, it says appointments to the board and filling the vacancy shall be made by the city council. We're not going to change that. And shall be representative, shall be a representative of cross-section of both lay and professional knowledge, which I think is left from when there was just a water board of trees, etc. Do other is such professional knowledge reference in other bylaws?
I don't know.
Okay, I don't have the book. It's not critical right now. This is enough.
Okay.
Does anyone have any feelings about that language? But I don't know how it compares to others. You know, shall be a cross section, including professional knowledge.
For myself, I think with the three that we've just passed, I think I'd like to get the feedback from council on whether or not they'd like to adopt them before we go a little farther myself.
All right, fine.
Okay. Three. We all okay? We're going to move on to number 9, new business. Discussion of underground utility districts. I believe Mr. Boucher has an updated information on new districts for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good night, Mr. Cunningham.
I'm actually recovering from my own special sickness.
We weren't going to say anything.
My fine operatic tenor is not back yet. The item before you is discussion of underground utility districts. Staff gets it, and I'm comfortable that the board gets a lot of inquiries from citizens on why XYZ Street doesn't have its overhead utility lines placed underground, and how does this process work, and what's up with that. So what I thought I would do is to give you some documents, a little factual basis, and then I put together a PowerPoint presentation that hopefully illustrates some of the points. The benefits of undergrounding overhead utilities are pretty clear from an aesthetic and a property value stance. This is just happens to be a photograph of Harbor Street, looking west on Harbor Street. From the fire department, looking down past the old Public Works building, the library and City Hall. And here's a photo simulation of what it would look like with no utility line. So clearly, in this civic area, it's a vast improvement. The city has had 6 underground utility districts that have been formed. districts 1 through 5, which were essentially, we've had 3 along the waterfront and 2 in the downtown area, have been completed. District number 6, which is Harbor Street and Morro Bay Boulevard from Main Street to Bernardo, has been formed, but we're in, I say, under discussion, trying to be as euphemistically appropriate as possible. We've now had some disagreements with utility companies on whether the district meets the criteria for the district. And we also have District number 7, as I mentioned earlier, which is along Main Street from Dunes to Highway 1 and on Beach Street from Main Street to Embarcadero, that this board took action on about a little more than a year ago. We've now met with the utility companies. They concur with the district boundaries, not as extended, but as the originally proposed, and we're ready to move forward to City Council and through the public hearing process. There are basically 3 foundation regulations for undergrounding overhead utilities, with the understanding that the electrical utility company, in our case PG&E, is the lead agency for the utilities. The first is Rule 20A of the California Public Utilities Commission. The second is Rule 20B, and the third is our own municipal code. Rule 20A basically does a number of things, but most importantly, it says that PG&E will place its facilities underground at its own cost under certain conditions. And that's the key. They will do it at their own cost. Now, PG&E and all the utilities, the electrical utilities, are required to set aside portions of their revenues on an annualized basis for the specific purposes of undergrounding overhead utilities. And they make annual allocations to each agency through which the agency can develop, in consultation with the utility companies, these underground district projects. Now, they're very specific. Go ahead.
Could I ask, the revenue or the allocations, like to Morro Bay, are related to Morro Bay's their revenues from Morro Bay?
Correct. It relates
doesn't
to the
come here and ours
that's
don't
correct.
Go elsewhere.
That's correct.
Okay. So the more people were to use electricity, the more there'd be.
Unfortunately, I'm not, yes. There's a connection
the
there.
So really
don't waste
good.
Electricity in order to do this. But yes, there is. It's basically, I believe the origin was 1% of their gross revenues in the area. Now, there are, not surprisingly, a number of pretty critical criteria that need to be looked at. There are these annual allocations are made. PG&E will put their facilities underground in concert with the other utility companies, the phone company, which is now SBC and Charter Communications, and anyone else who happens to be on the poles. For example, the school district has their UMAN system, which is a fiber optic system that they have that connects all their schools. They are on some of those poles. So if and when those facilities are undergrounded, the school district then has to participate at their own cost. The process is that the city council forms an underground utility district after consultation with PG&E and making determinations that the undergrounding is in the general public interest. Now, those are a couple pretty important phrases there, most particularly general public interest.
If, back to cost, if one of the criteria is it's done in conjunction with others, with other utilities or agencies, the phone company would have to finance their own?
That is correct.
And if the phone company doesn't want to, that's not going to meet the criteria.
That's false.
Okay.
The phone, basically how it plays out is in the real world, the poles are generally jointly owned. And they have a joint pole association with, that it, that ascribes the costs and the maintenance and the replacement for all the poles that the utility companies share. PG&E is the lead on that. Everybody, the utility companies pay PG&E to put in the poles, to maintain the poles. PG&E takes their stuff off, and the poles are gone. So there's a number of processes that go along with it, but if PG&E goes, everybody else has to go.
But if they aren't all using the same pole, it won't go.
Then we'll get into that, because okay. That's the precisely the crux of our issues with Underground District 6. Now, the criteria are such undergrounding, well, there's three. Such undergrounding will avoid or eliminate an unusually heavy concentration of overhead electrical facilities. This particular pole that I chose to look at is at the corner of Quintana Place and Main Street. That's in the proposed Underground District 7. As you can see, there's whole bunches of stuff on this pole, not the least of which is, and I picked this pole because it's a good example of what, from the PG&E standpoint, would be considered an unusual concentration, a heavy concentration of electrical utilities. Up on the very top, you have the primary electrical facilities, the 12,000-volt lines. Below them, you've got the secondary lines from which these individual service connections to the properties come. Below that, you've got Charter Communication, cable TV, and then the big fat honkers, technical term there, is the phone company. So when you see those big, perhaps less than attractive cables across the street, those are almost always phone. The electrical lines up on the top, those high tension lines, the 12,000 volts, are rarely extremely visible, but they are visible. So that's one of the criteria. And if you don't see primary PG&E along with secondary PG&E, you're not going to get that criteria. It's also this up here on this primary run is where you see those big transformers. The next criteria is that the street or road or right-of-way wherein these utilities exist is extensively used by the general public and carries a heavy volume of pedestrian or vehicular traffic. Again, this is one of our streets that's in the proposed district. This is the intersection of Beach and Main. Clearly, now I happened to go out there this morning when there wasn't a lot of traffic, but clearly Main Street and Beach Street are two of the major streets in the communities. You can see, and I think this is Dr. Dorfman pointed out, what if they're not on the same poles? Very often they're not. You see on the here on the east side of Main Street is the phone lines. On the west side of Main Street is electrical, and then running down the south side of Beach Street towards Embarcadero is everybody. The third criteria is that the street or road of right-of-way adjoins or passes through a civic area or public recreation area or an area of unusual scenic interest to the general public. Again, this is one that I chose, which is in the civic area, taken from in front of the fire department, library, city hall, generally the civic campus of the community. Now, as was pointed out earlier, there are some areas in which we don't agree. Morro Bay Boulevard is one example. Along Morro Bay Boulevard, there is, running down the boulevard, is only telephone. This is the Shasta intersection right here. At Shasta, there are electrical lines that cross, and some fairly major lines cross at Piney Way and at Napa. But smaller lines cross. Now, where the businesses on Morro Bay Boulevard get their electricity and their cable TV are from easements in the backyards. So this is where we're getting our disagreements, is that none of the utility companies have a problem or object to including Harbor Street in an underground district because everybody's on that street, as we saw in that last photo. Well, and I can scroll back to it to see that here we are on Harbor Street. You've got primary and secondary PG&E running down the north side of the street. You've got big phone going north-south. You've got phone and cable TV on the south side, so it's bracketed going down both sides of the street. Here on Morro Bay Boulevard, you've got the large phone cable, not as the largest of the large phone cable, but the power and cable TV runs down the backyard easements on both sides.
On poles or?
On poles, yes.
And you're saying backyard easement, so it's running between the Morro Bay Boulevard properties and the Pacific and Harbor Street properties?
That is correct. That is correct. Now, one of the difficulties there, one of the difficulties with these backyard easements in this particular case, if you happen to look at that neighborhood, is that you're in a commercial district, and very often in a commercial district, you'll see zero setback for commercial properties. So what we have along here are literally buildings that are built touching each other that have electrical and cable TV and some phone lines running over the top of them. Virtually impossible to put those lines underground in their current in their current location, so they're in their current rights of way. And so this is what the crux of the argument is that the utility companies are saying that the extent that they have to do their work is not comparable or equitable. And so that's one of the sources of discussions, and we're trying to work through that now. One of the things that we did on Morro Bay Boulevard is that you may, in anticipation that this has been a problem for a number of years, and we've been going back and forth.
When you say, who is saying they're having to do more than their fair share?
The telephone company.
Because they're easements, and they'd have to move them.
Because their facilities that we want them to put underground on Morro Bay Boulevard are not proximate, not close, yeah, to the facilities that we would be requiring PG&E and cable TV
so
to put underground.
Costs them.
It costs more money.
And they don't have this funding source like PG&E.
So they have to budget it, and so they get into their budget cycles. Now, at the risk of going into 20B, I will say that if you'll recall, a couple years ago, we did the ornamental street lighting project on three blocks of Morro Bay Boulevard, but from Main Street to Napa. During that project, we put spare conduits in the ground. And if you look at the criteria, and we'll talk about it a little bit later under Rule 20B, the utilities will put their facilities underground if the applicant, us, installs such conduits and vaults and boxes, and that's what we're doing. So we're kind of thinking that we weren't going to be able to make this underground district fly on Morro Bay Boulevard. So the only way that we could really get something done in the long haul to get these phone lines underground was for us to take advantage of an opportunity to put in conduit when we're already putting in conduit, thereby maximizing our utility, and then come back and say, your facilities are ready for you, put your stuff underground. So that's the plan there. But that's been a source of contention. This underground district was formed in late 1998, and it isn't done yet. So we're now looking at umpteen years and hopefully getting ready to move forward. Another area that we don't agree on is kind of our poster boy for one area that we don't agree on. This is one that we wanted to put in District 7 that the utility companies don't agree with. They make a point that this is not a civic area.
Is that Dune Street?
This is the end of Dune Street, yes. It's in a residential area. There is, it's at the top of the bluff, and we're talking about the two blocks from Main Street to the top of the bluff. Personally, I think it's one of the most scenic spots in the community. It's got a great cypress tree, a great view of the bay and the rock and the ocean. And the utilities companies point out, and I think with some logic, this is a residential area, so therefore it doesn't have the traffic and heavy pedestrian or vehicular traffic referred to one criteria. It's residential. It's not civic. There's minimal parking. The only thing that we can say is that we have a bench on the end of the street. Unfortunately, right next to the bench is a no trespassing sign. So we disagree on this one. I would love to get this undergrounded, but I'm not sure we can get
there
yet.
Do we have a stairway there?
No, we do not.
Is the rule heavy vehicular and pedestrian, or heavy vehicular or pedestrian?
It's or.
Or, because that's a popular, people bicycle around. They always go, you just stop.
Yes, it's a popular spot. Heavy would be the operant adjective at that point. Another area that we look at, and this is probably the most common call that we get. This just happens to be the view out of somebody's living room window. And this is, unfortunately, it's all too typical. You have potentially a panoramic ocean view that is somewhat compromised by the location of this pole. And you can see that does have the, because you can see the bottom of the transformer, it has the primary lines up above, but, you know, the roof line kind of rejected. It's got the secondary. It's got your cable TV. It's got your big honking phone cables. Now, I should point out that the designer of this house, this is the worst case. The designer did take advantage of the view to the southwest and was able to maximize their view. This is kind of off to the side and probably not something that the owners, once they move in, will really want to look at. But this is very often what we get, and when people call us about why aren't you doing undergrounding, this is the kind of situation that they try to address, and justifiably so. But I don't think that you can make much of a point that it's in the general public interest, or this is an area that is of scenic interest to the general public.
So it's basically, it's a definitional problem. The city doesn't, why go to the trouble and paperwork of years of developing an underground district to know that it won't meet the criteria that will allow it to be done?
Correct. Now, and frankly, it's kind of, I've kind of led up to the, really, I think where a lot of this goes is that we get lots of calls, and I'm comfortable that the board members get it. Why aren't we pushing for undergrounding on Main Street? This is an area of discussion. This is Main Street at Hill, that the trailer park at Hill Street. And maybe it doesn't show so well, but you've got three heavy phone cables, and there must be 15 or 20 individual phone lines that come off of this one pole, maybe 30, that go to the individual trailers. Below that, you've got a couple of cable TV lines. And on the very, very top, what you can't see, is there's one wire that goes to a street light. So doesn't meet the heavy concentration of electrical facilities by any stretch of the imagination, but it is on a road that's extensively used by the public, that's heavily traveled. While this is not probably the view you're looking at, but you, I suppose you might be able to make some sort of argument about view shed. But this is one of the areas that we have trouble meeting the criteria.
Okay. Are the criteria, those three, heavy concentration of electrical facilities, heavy use of the right-of-way, and the right-of-way passes through the civic areas, are those or?
One or more.
One or more.
One or more. And what we get into on this particular location, again, is we get into the guidelines of the comparability of the facilities. Now, there's a little bit different on Main Street because there are underground conduits that the phone company has in Main Street, and we're trying to work with them to help them to take advantage of their existing infrastructure. But to get them to fund that work when the other utility companies would have only minor relative expenditures is a difficult threshold for them to cross. Here's another spot. This is Palm Street at Acacia, looking south in the south end of the bay. Great view again. Once again, a great view. You've got primary power, you've got secondary, you've got phone, you've got cable, you've got a number of poles, and pretty well interferes with the view. I tried to make it clear that this is a public view from a public street, not from somebody's deck or front yard. This might meet one of the criteria because it adjoins or an area of unusual scenic interest, but does it meet enough criteria to even to prioritize it relative to something else? I don't know, and that's why I just have it as an area of potential discussion. Here we are. Here's another spot which would be typical. This is Nutmeg. This is taken from someone's front yard. Again, nice view. Big pole, lots of wires, big cables, view shed issues. But this is a view from somebody's yard, not really of general public interest. Here's another part of Main Street, which maybe the cables are heavier and easier to see, but this is north of Sequoia. Again, you've got these poles, and if you look at these poles aren't so bad, but the ones to the south lean over. They lean to the west significantly. But what you have here with these two big cross arms is you've got 3- and 4-inch phone cables. You've got one little television cable, and again, you've got the sleek little one wire running to that street light. Again, we would love to get this stuff underground. It gets into comparability issues, gets into meeting the criteria. Now, Rule 20B, which is obviously the successor to Rule 20A, says that the utility companies will do the same thing if you pay for it. Makes it much less desirable by any stretch of the imagination. But what we're seeing is now, like what we're pursuing kind of incrementally on Morro Bay Boulevard, and what we're seeing from a number of the neighborhoods is that people are taking it on themselves to pursue undergrounding of the utilities that don't meet these criteria because they are concerned about the view from their living room. They're concerned about their view from their deck, and with property values, they seem to be willing to spend numbers of thousands of dollars.
Explain how that works. You said that if you pay for it, they will do the same thing?
They will underground their facilities if the applicant pays all the costs.
For them to underground?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
That's the comparability issue has to do not with the criteria, but with implementation of drawing down really the PG&E money. This has nothing to do with that.
That's correct. This is all about who pays.
In other words, something can meet the criteria, but there's implementation requires some sense of comparability in expenditure among different utilities.
Correct.
Or they can say, no, we're not going to.
Correct.
Do it.
Now, a couple of the critical 20B elements is that a group of citizens are not applicants. Applicants are the city or the county or whatever the local agency would be. The applicant agrees to pay all the costs for the design, the construction, the installation of the underground utilities, the demolition or the wrecking of the removal of the overhead facilities. Now, where this usually winds up is that, and it's what we've seen more recent times with a number of proposals, at least four of them over the last few years, is that groups of citizens, a block at a time or 20 or an area at a time, get together and they want to pursue underground the utilities in their neighborhood. They pay the utility companies to prepare the cost estimates. And at that point, there's a number of machinations, and I included the Manhattan Beach stuff in the package. There are procedures for these property owners to petition the local agency, in our case the city, to form an assessment district. Now, there's a number of steps on the front end of this, but it involves forming an assessment district, involves elections, costs, the sale of bonds, because generally people want to put it on their property taxes and pay it off over a period of 20 or 30 years. So there's a bond that has to be sold. So there's legal requirements, there's financial requirements. You're basically putting liens on the properties. And there's quite a bit of expense and time and effort that goes into the whole thing. Most of these costs are recovered through the district, but on the front end, those costs for the formation of the district are not part of the district costs.
By that, are you meaning the city fronts the bill until things are done and then it's recovered from the assessment district?
Well, the way that I've... There are costs on the front end. The costs involve informing the district that cannot be paid for by the district. From the second the district is formed, then the district picks up all those costs from there on. But those preliminary costs aren't covered by the district. So I've seen some agencies require people to form two districts. First, they form a district to pay the costs of forming the district, and then the district covers the rest. And it's a methodology through which the local agency recovers the costs of the staff time primarily to put everything together for the election, because there's an actual election that goes on, and taking the petition to the city council and going through all those preliminary steps. Now, one thing I put on here is that for the formation of such a district in our community, the city staff time would be subject to reimbursement by one vehicle or another. But in our case, with having a few people, it's not just the reimbursement. It's we don't have an underground utility specialist, so we don't have someone allocated to do this work. So you're taking me away from doing something else to do this underground district on behalf of 12 or 15 or 20 property owners.
Well, could you... the city do it through the city contracting with the specialist, and then the group is paying the cost?
That would be that preliminary, those citizens would have to agree to pay those costs.
Yeah.
Now, what happens, and what's happened on some of these districts, is that where it always seems to get hung up, or where it's gotten hung up to date, is that a lot of these lines are in backyard easements. So if I'm in the uphill side and I'm looking out my deck, I've got that big phone cable right at eye height, and I'm really motivated to get that line put underground. But the neighbor downhill, who has a perfectly fine unobstructed view, has no interest in paying thousands of dollars to put those lines back there underground.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where where the problem lies with trying to have a small district, because I have no interest in putting those lines underground, but there might be another set of poles down in that next block that I'm interested in that I might want to participate in, and that kind of leapfrogs that way. So forming the district sounds good. The private parties doing it sounds pretty good. They've got a number of districts that have been formed in Manhattan Beach. And perhaps we're approaching Manhattan Beach property values in the future. I don't think we're there yet, but you know, that's something that I think is I won't say it's a wave of the future, but that is one way. If people are really motivated to improve their views and improve their property values, where it's not in the general public interest, where there's not the unusual concentration, where it doesn't meet those 20A rules, that's about the only way it's going to happen. Now, just to give you an idea of the cost, PG&E currently estimates that it costs them about $1 million a mile to convert their facilities from overhead to underground. Now, clearly, cable TV is significantly less. Phone would vary. They'd be a lot less, but you can see on some of the areas they've got small phone lines, and some of them they got their major trunk lines, which are 3-4 inch, you know, diameter lines that are really quite significant. So I'm asking, they're putting together cost estimates now for Underground District 7, so we'll have a fairly good idea of what kind of major conversions for the phone company will be running. Now, I mentioned that the backyard easements and the residential areas generally don't meet the criteria for a 20A. So one of the things that you would look at for means through which, maybe on a property by property or an area by area basis, where things could be undergrounded, would be in concert with development or redevelopment of properties. We would do that through our zoning ordinance. And section 1748.050 of the Morro Bay Municipal Code says that all utility lines to all new development except single-family residences on vacant lands, including the demolition and replacement of individual structures, and to major redevelopment projects shall be undergrounded. That says that if I build anything other than a single family dwelling, I have to underground the services from my property to the nearest pole, basically, and then a riser up the pole. What that's given rise to is that there'll be a property that'll develop and there's a pole 100 feet away. So I have to run conduit out into the public right-of-way and then run it down the street 100 feet and get it to that pole. Now, if I have a single-family dwelling, I can just have the utility company go out and run overhead service. Now, the second section, so you see, if I'm doing underground service and I'm just running it out and going to the nearest pole, eventually you have a bunch of spaghetti out of these small conduits running all over the place, and it does nothing to get the main run of the overheads, the main lines done. Our ordinance goes on to state, for any project 1.5 acres or larger, all electrical and communication lines located on or immediately adjacent to the project shall be undergrounded in accordance with the applicable rules and regulations of the CPUC. What that tells us is, if we have a project that's 1.5 acres or larger, at that point, the property has to underground the main runs out in front.
Okay. It can be a project composed of single-family dwellings, but because the project is as a project, I mean, I'm trying to understand how
it my under,
take the Colmer thing. That's single-family.
Okay, Colmer, the Colmer at Main and South.
Yeah, yeah,
that was one large property that was subdivided into 30 parcels. Yes, that would be subject to undergrounding.
Because of the 1.5 acre.
If it meets the 1.5 acre, and I don't know off the top, I don't know off the top of my head, is it 1.5 acre? I don't know.
Don't.
You see, that's the totality
but
of.
Why was that subject to undergrounding then?
If it's 1.5 acres or larger, it would be subject to that.
Meaning
the entire the subdivision.
Okay.
Now you've got another project, which is at Main and Quintana, which were a bunch of previously subdivided lots that are coincidentally being built at once. So you've got. That's not 1.5 acres. So the obvious question is, how many pieces of ground are there in this community that are 1.5 acres?
Yeah.
Cloisters. Cloisters was all put underground. So that would comply.
But that was only because it was one developer.
And that was one developer. So, you know, so from a practical aspect, completely excluding single-family dwellings, and by putting that 1.5 acre threshold for undergrounding the main trunk lines, does that really help this community get to the vision of undergrounding if we want to go that way? Does that get us there? My understanding is, and I haven't done any research on it, that Morro Bay could very well be the only city in the county, including the county itself, that doesn't require all development to go underground.
Regardless of the size.
Correct. So, if we want to pursue, on a community-wide basis, undergrounding, and I think it's pretty clear that the community does, if there was lots of money, that would certainly be a priority. I think there's a number of ways that we can pursue it. One is that we can modify the ordinance to come in line, shall we say, come in line with the other agencies in the county. That way, over as properties redevelop and recycle, we would eventually see this occur. And maybe on these smaller properties, there'd be CC&Rs or covenants on the deed that the individual property owners would agree to participate in an undergrounding district or something along those lines.
Would you have things like a single-family residence, they put an overhead, but as they're doing the driveway, the street work, the sidewalk work, they do it like you did on Morro Bay, require those kinds of things so as things get built?
I think that's something that could definitely facilitate the eventual undergrounding.
Because
yes.
if it's truly $1 million a mile, that costs out at more than $200 per running foot. I have a 100-foot front. It's 20,000.
Yep. And it works to both sides of the street. So theoretically, that cost would be halved by being shared by the people across the street. Okay. So that would be one methodology to eventually help get us there, is to change the ordinance and incrementally over a period of, frankly, perhaps 100 years, things would all go underground.
And that would be City Council or Planning Commission that would need to...
Correct.
Do you know, does the general plan address goals in relation to undergrounding?
No, I don't know. I'm comfortable that in the utilities are addressed in the circulation element. The circulation element does have goals in there to provide for undergrounding, but it doesn't provide the mechanisms, and that's what we would be looking for here, if this is where we would want to go. Another mechanism would be clearly is to form assessment districts to make it happen, and these costs would be paid for by the properties as a lien on their property tax, and then they could pay it off the $10,000 or $20,000 over a period of 20 or 30 years. We can do that by either the City Council forming the districts, which with Proposition 218 gets into quite a few subtleties, or we could encourage, such as Manhattan Beach does, we could encourage and facilitate the formation by property owner-initiated assessment districts. Another thing that we could do, or a combination of things, is that when we have budgetary capabilities, we budget to put in a block or two of conduits, and that we decide, okay, this year we've got X number of dollars available for this, so we're going to install conduits on Main Street from San Jacinto to Island. And so that incrementally, again, another methodology to be prepared for the conversion. Or we can wait for 20A. Eventually, anything that is close to meeting the criteria, I mean, we're kind of at the point now with only our seventh utility district where the stuff that we're talking about meets all three criteria. Eventually, over a period of years, we'll work our way through those districts, and then we'll be working on ones that meet two of the criteria and one of the criteria, and eventually we'll... You know, we've been doing districts. When I first came here, we were just in the construction phase of district number two. So about every 5 years, we can do a district. About a half a mile at a time.
Or trying to understand what, to some degree, what you're... telling us, and let me say something explicit that I think maybe you're implying. The city assists with the district, with the formation of the districts. Its codes walk both sides of the street, and so, no pun intended, and so it's murky. There's not an unambiguous commitment to undergrounding the city, because there's no clear policy statement on it any place.
I think in the circulation element, there's the policy, but not the implementation capability.
Okay, that helps clarify.
So I guess that's kind of the conclusion I wanted to give you. In summary, I think it's universally desirable from everyone that I've talked to underground the utilities. It's a question of methodology. How do we make it happen? And I think we probably can't address all the situations by one means. Not all parts of the community will meet the 20A criteria. So even if we get all those areas done, there's still going to be the backyards. One of the areas I forgot to mention is where there are areas where there's backyard easements now, how do you facilitate converting those out into the front. The utility companies don't want to work in the backyards. It's not a good situation because there's fences and hedges and shrubs and sheds and dogs and stuff. They would, if they're going to go underground, they would much rather go out in the street. Well, how do we facilitate that? Do we have a thing where, you know, if you redevelop a property or you develop a property where the lines are in the backyard now, do we tell them to put blank conduits out to the front that'll be connected to at some point, perhaps? You know, and what are we doing there? Are we just fostering the conduit industry of America, or what? But being prepared to facilitate when the community is ready to move forward, to be ready for it, you know, is I perceive, and what people tell me is that they would like to see their individual part of the community undergrounded. So I think you see that as a goal, and I hope that we can look to steps that we can take, proactive steps, to help the community realize that goal, to facilitate it into the future. So I don't really have any recommendation for an action for you tonight. This was hopefully more of information to broaden your perspective on it. But if you would like to make a recommendation to the council, certainly feel free. And I encourage any questions and discussion you would wish.
Well, members, do you have any questions? Barry? Bill? No? Okay. Well, I hope that...
Is it desirable that we recommend to the council?
Is it desirable that we recommend to the council that they go ahead with this next... you know, they're already going to... Everybody want that, don't they? Everybody wants it, don't they? Does it make any difference if we recommend it or not? I mean, this.
You're talking about Underground District 7?
This number 7, yeah.
Okay, the board had already taken an action to recommend that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So we did that before.
Correct.
This was more than a year ago, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, so therefore, that still stands.
See, I presume so, yes.
Yeah. I think that it would be premature to send something to the council for the following reason. That's one of the things as an advisory board we should do is flush out a little more some of the possibilities, because basically what you've raised is, are there things that the city could be doing to facilitate putting into action, actually getting the city undergrounded at a faster rate. And I think this has been a good foundation, but need to learn more to see if there are things. While it's attractive to think, well, change the ordinance and make it this way or that way, that's not necessarily something to do if there isn't enough build-out to really make that difference. I think certainly the area of remodeling and construction on existing sites is very active in Morro Bay. People are tearing down houses, except for one wall, so it's a so it's a remodel. It's all the time, and yet you don't want to take an individual property owner and say, okay, because you're doing it, you have to. But some of those incremental things, so eventually it's over a few years a block is ready to go, and maybe if that block is. So I think that would take more discussion, because I don't think it's helpful to the council if they haven't sent it to us to say, hey, you ought to do some more work on this, unless we do some more work first.
And I should point out, I neglected to say it, that The properties are existing developed properties are plumbed, if you will, to receive their utilities from up above. So your electric meter on your side of your house has a little weather head that punches through the roof and sticks up, a little mast sticks up, and then everything goes overhead. Well, the property owners then have to turn all their services around to receive the utilities from underground. So there are, I won't say that they're major expenses in the classic sense of the term, but in a matter of $1,000 or so, perhaps $2,000, to convert that service to accept undergrounding. So there are additional expenses.
But the question along that line I would have is, what is the cost of building, say I'm building a new house or major remodel, having to redo my electrical, of facilitating the turnaround?
This is going to require any kind of motion from us, because I think that it is moving, although it's slowly. One of the things that I think that this board can really do and is doing is the fact that this is information. The public watching is getting more information, getting more knowledge, including ways to advocate to council how they feel that should be taken on. It's a really big picture, so any motion from us other than carry on would be maybe a little inappropriate at this time. I think we're moving in the right direction. It's just very slow because of the definitions, and things can be changed, but there again, Council and Planning Commission have the authority to do that, and I think maybe in time they will get there. But I do appreciate the fact that we've taken the time tonight. Mr. Boucher, thank you for bringing it. I hope that it brings a lot of information to the folks in North Morro Bay, especially because that's where some of the concerns that I'm getting from. Why aren't we doing this there? And I hope that it's a little clearer that it's not foot dragging at all. It's desired. It's desired by everybody. I haven't heard, I think maybe a couple of comments about some of the maintenance of underground utilities are the only grumblings that I've ever heard. But people support this. This is something that's good for all of us, and it's going to be happening. By definitions of how it works, with the information that we've been given, I hope that you understand that these are the things that we're addressing. And you've got some options as far as establishing, assessment districts and things like that. So I consider
Madam
it very
Chair,
valuable.
You raise a very good point on the it's slow. If today Underground District 7 was approved, and there is a process, a public hearing process, and property owners' notifications and lots of stuff like that. Because of the other utility districts that are formed in our region, which includes Hart County and Santa Barbara County, I was told yesterday that if it were formed today, we probably wouldn't see construction until early 2008. So if we're ready to go, we're still not ready to go.
Yeah. 2.5 years. It's a long process, and I hope, I think those of us, we've been on the board, we've been involved, we understand some of that. I hope nobody thinks that we're being short when we say you really don't have any idea how complicated this is. I hope that this has shed a little bit of light on it, and I hope that you understand not only that there's a lot of roadblocks, you've got some directions, and you can work on those. Private citizens have a lot of clout, and this board is open to public comment, and so is City Council, and so are all the other boards. So this is part of participating. Probably really iffy for December.
Correct.
And our next meeting would be scheduled December 21st, and I will say now that a few days before the holiday for many people, our meeting has typically been canceled for December. That's not a given, and I don't know if the board would like to discuss or decide that now, or if we should hold off. Well, what is staff's spin on that?
I think you can discuss that and make a decision on what you would like to do.
Well, the three of us. Gentlemen, what do you think? I don't have the actual numbers of how many meetings have been canceled versus how many have carried, but I know in my 5 years or so on the board, I think we've only had one December meeting.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything pressing that I recall. I was trying to look at what Frank brought up.
Frank has two items that he would like to bring. One is the petition for signalization or intersection improvements at South Bay Boulevard and Quintana.
Do you have a sense of the timeline he has to meet on that?
He, as he pointed out, he's waiting for the traffic engineer to complete the analysis. So, and I don't know when that's here, but it's not here now. Mm. The other item is we have received a request to install a crosswalk.
Was that his second item?
Yes, on Atascadero Road at the West High School entryway. And I don't know what the time element is on that.
Okay. See,
that's for going from the high school to the sewer plant.
It's to go from the high school to across the road at the desalter, yeah. But it would be for people to go that direction, to the beach.
Make the meeting. I would really continue to make it tied because it's a tough month for staff. People are going a lot. If these two items, it's really my sense of the timeliness for these two items. I mean, if he gets a traffic study and the developer is really trying to move things along, it's not fair not to have it. But if it, you know, doesn't really matter, a timeliness issue on those two issues, and if there isn't, I think it's in everyone's interest not to have the meeting.
Okay, so we will leave it open. Tentatively, we most likely will not have a meeting. That's for folks to understand. If you find out that the meeting is canceled, you will understand why. We will be waiting for the progress of the items that we have tentatively for agenda items. If they're not ready, it is it's not prudent time-wise and staff-wise for us to meet.
Yeah. And I think that decision should be made by the middle of the month.
Okay. So we'll be in contact.
Oh, comfortably. Yeah. Comfortably. We would. I would say easily by the first week of the month.
Yeah.
Because that's when we would be working on the agenda items that first week.
And you'll notify us, and it won't count unless you get a confirmation back.
Absolutely. Whatever decision is made, an email will go out to all current board members as well as staff, so everyone's on the same page. Okay? We will do that. Okay, is there any other comments before we close, gentlemen?
My larger email is working.
Okay, the email is working. Bill, I wanted to ask, too, the timers on the streetlights downtown in the district, they are still not on when it's dark. Can we adjust the timers since the clock changed?
With daylight savings?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'll pass the memo on. Yes.
Thank you very much. All right, motion for adjourn?
So moved.
Second? All right, we are adjourned. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us. And we may be back here on December 21st. If not, we will see you in January of 2006. Thank you for joining us.